Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larkin, Judge Johnson, Judge Bjorkman, the Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Thank you. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals this fourth day of November 2020. We have one case remaining on our oral argument calendar this morning. That case is State v. Knorr. We're hearing oral argument this morning remotely due to the pandemic on the Zoom platform. Our procedural rules are the same. Each of the attorneys arguing will have 15 minutes to present primary argument. Counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes of time for rebuttal argument. Oral arguments are recorded by the court. The audio recordings of those arguments are generally available within 24 hours on the Court of Appeals page at the Judicial Branch's website at mincourts.gov. Minnesota Rules of Civil Appellate Procedure 134.10 prohibits anyone else from making an audio or video recording of an oral argument of the court unless they have received the court's permission at least 24 hours in advance and they have agreed to comply with specific conditions established by the Minnesota Supreme Court. Several media outlets have made advanced arrangements to record the arguments in the Knorr case and to comply with the Supreme Court's conditions. The Court of Appeals rules of decorum prohibit demonstrations, including signs, banners, or displays of symbols. They also provide that any distracting activity will be grounds for removal from the courtroom, or in this case, the Zoom oral argument. Only the judges and the attorneys who are arguing before the court are allowed to activate their video and audio functions during a remote oral argument. If you are not an attorney arguing before the court in the case being heard and you turn your video on, you will be immediately removed from the Zoom session and you will not be able to rejoin. This rule applies to the media who are recording the hearing this morning. I am assured that their inability to use their video function will not impact their recording ability. So with that, we are ready to hear arguments from counsel for the appellant. Counsel, would you introduce yourself and begin your argument?
And please, counsel, my name is Thomas Plunkett. I appear on behalf of Mohammed Knorr. Multiple errors, most of a constitutional magnitude, pervaded Knorr's trial. We respectfully ask this court to reverse his convictions and either dismiss the case or remand for retrial on any remaining count with rulings that provide Knorr with his constitutionally guaranteed right to defend himself in a fair proceeding. This case stems from an officer-involved shooting in Southwest Minneapolis on July 15th, 2017. The events received considerable attention at the time. I would like to address two issues during this argument: sufficiency and the right to present a complete defense. The evidence was insufficient. The state asked this court to ignore the Minnesota Supreme Court's explicit instructions. Third-degree murder cannot occur where the defendant's actions were focused on a specific person. State v. Zumber, 2017. State v. Barnes, 2006. State v. Harris, 2006. State v. Fox, 1983. State v. Wahlberg, 1980. State v. Hansen, 1970. They all tell us what murder three is not, going all the way back to State v. Lowe in 1896, where murder in the third degree was reversed for insufficient evidence. We have over 100 years of legal precedent, and the law remains unchanged by the legislature. There are two important issues on this point. First, how is Knorr affected by State v. Hall? And how is Knorr distinguished from State v. Mitek? Turning to the Hall decision, Hall did not change the law. The decision clarified elements. Hall specifically states that Hansen's statement that murder in the third degree excludes a situation where the animus of defendant is directed towards only one person is not overruled. Ultimately, Paul looked at elements more than sufficiency.
Mr. Plunkett, I just want to stop you a minute there to talk about Hansen. As I understand the law going way back to Lowe, the phrase without intent to affect the death of any other person has been interpreted by our Supreme Court to me to exclude the situation where a particular person is the object of the action, correct?
I'd agree with that, yes, Your Honor.
And the Hall case, as I read it, which basically reaffirms the Supreme Court's decision in Mitich, says that language about without intending to affect the death of any person is not an element of the murder three offense, correct?
It does say that it's not an element, but if I can expand on that question, it doesn't say that it's not given its distinct own elemental status. But when you are looking at element three, the element of depraved mind, it's very much, it continues to be part of that element. That's what I think the case says, Your Honor. In the state's, if I may continue, then this, in the state's brief, they point to Harity and his partner and the late night bicyclist and their potential danger as claims that a depraved heart existed. But that's not a correct application of the law on murder three. When we look at Hansen, which is the Minnesota farmer case who went from Pine County over to Traverse County to see his estranged wife and shot her with a .22 caliber rifle, there was a person standing very close to her, I think approximately 8 feet away, when that was Mrs. Nicolausen, the neighbor.
Mr. Plunkett, Judge Larkin, let me interrupt you because you seem to have moved from argument regarding the particular person aspect of third degree murder to the depraved mind aspect. And before you do that, it might be helpful if you could address why MITOC is not relevant here. And I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that, but it is a case you mentioned as a bearing on the argument. Could you address that argument or that case, which was a case in which the Supreme Court allowed a conviction for third degree murder, even though the acts resulting in the killings were definitely directed at particular people?
Okay, yes, Your Honor. And I didn't mean to say that MITOC isn't relevant. I just don't think it's dispositive to our argument.
Okay, and why is that?
Well, what we're looking at, when you look at MITOC, they talked about what is a depraved mind? It's a mind that's ceased to care. And that is a particular person requirement is part of that analysis. In MITOC, the person traveled from Chicago. They purchased a gun. They traveled under an assumed name. They took the cab to the bus stop and then another cab to the house. And, you know, the relationship before that, the nature of that relationship was that this was a scorned lover who showed up and ceased to care. And when you're looking at the particular person requirement, it is that, how does it affect what is a depraved mind? When you're focused on a particular person, you don't have a depraved mind. When you look at MITOC, I've been calling it MITICH, so I apologize. I'm not sure what the proper spelling is, pronunciation. But when we look at that case, I think that what we learn is that you need some kind of a frenzied anger. You need something that would overcome would show a depraved mind. And when you're consciously focusing on an individual person, you don't have a depraved mind. The same as in Hall, when we look at Hall, how that person decided to commit suicide and didn't care who or what she hit, didn't care that she was going to kill herself, was all it was, and she suffered from some pre-existing mental illness conditions. So the point I'm trying to make is the cases might not have given this a full separate element as the status of but the concept is alive and well in the idea of what constitutes a depraved mind. And if a mind is of such intent, or pardon me, not intent, that's clearly the wrong word, but if a mind is of such purpose as to focus on an individual, to focus on a target, it's no longer depraved.
Mr. Plunkett, how is your argument impacted by our court's recent decision in State versus Coleman, where we issued a decision about how depraved mind is defined in this statute?
Again, when we look at the facts of Coleman, you see, I think that's the Forest Lake snowmobiler case. And that's that person had been consumed alcohol, had been out, I guess, riding the snowmobile on a crowded lake at night and in such conditions that, you know, he just didn't, you know, he was so reckless that it was a depraved mind. I really took the Coleman decision to focus on what role the element of recklessness has in deciding a third degree murder case. And so it is also distinguishable in that regard. Did I answer your question thoroughly, or?
Well, my question is, nowhere in Coleman do we suggest that the particular person or the absence of a particular person is relevant to the question of, or to the definition, the legal definition of what a depraved mind is. And that, how do you react to that?
Well, Coleman wasn't focused on a particular person. It was a to whom it may concern action. And the reckless, because anybody on the lake could have been harmed or injured. But it's the recklessness that I thought was the focus of Coleman and determining the element, how the element of the case should properly be defined and how the jig is properly defined. So I don't know, I'm saying that I don't think Coleman is dispositive of the facts in this case.
Is Coleman relevant? Because Coleman does set forth a test based on recklessness and says that that test, if satisfied, establishes the existence of the depraved mind mens rea element that is necessary for third degree murder. So should we be considering whether the test articulated in Coleman applies when we're assessing whether the evidence was sufficient to show a depraved mind in this case?
When we're looking at what, I mean, we always have to come back to, I believe we always have to come back to, what is a depraved mind? And when we're looking at Coleman, I didn't see that Coleman really focused on how do you define a depraved mind. If you're reckless to that regard, that it's to the level where you're, you know, the examples are, you know, frenzied anger, passion, fueled with alcohol. All of these things are what is a depraved mind. Most of the precedent we have and that I've cited is what a depraved mind is not. And it is not a situation where somebody is acting in a blink of an eye. It is, as is the case in Noor, it is not a situation where somebody is acting purposefully, is directing, you know, at a particular person. It's a purposeful act. That is much different than Coleman, which is very distinguished factually because of the extraordinary generalized harm, potential for harm that was thrown out to the public.
Well, what would you say to the state's argument that there was more generalized harm in this case based on the presence of the officer in the front seat and the bicyclist and anybody else who might have been present outside of the car?
I respectfully disagree with the state. When you look at the factual setup, the bicyclist, if you look at the transcript, was probably at a 90 degree angle from the air, the direction of fire. The partner, the state tries to say that the partner was so scared that he had to move his limbs to see if he'd been shot. That's not what he said. His testimony on that point was that the partner wasn't sure where the round had come from. So that's why he moved his limbs. It had nothing to do with having a concern or being put in harm's way. You also have to look at the idea that in Noor, he was doing the work of a police officer. And he did it in a way that he could minimize the risks. He was aware of these other things, of the bicyclist. He was aware of his partner. And he tried to mitigate, unlike other cases where, or all of the cases where the perpetrator did not care, had no regard for their potential safety. And he was in a different role when this offense occurred. So I think that's very different and is quite distinguished from those facts.
Mr. Plunkett, I'd like to ask you a question about the statutory defense that allows officers to use force in certain circumstances. In your brief, you cite federal case law arising from Section 1983 and the Fourth Amendment. Why would we look to that law here when the statutory defense is a state statute, a matter of state law?
I think that you have to look to the federal law because the state statute does take away from the federal law. The federal law outlines the framework of it. And I think that it's very applicable. It's been looked at in forming jigs in every police officer involved case that I've been involved in involves some kind of an assault. I don't think that we can say that it's inapplicable because it's a civil rights case. It is looking very specifically on what is a use of force, when is an officer's use of force appropriate, and it gives excellent guidance that it needs. How do we evaluate it? Evaluating it in the context of the moment it occurs, no 2020 hindsight, not looking back on the events, and it absolutely informs the Minnesota statute on the same.
So Art, the statute here, to paraphrase a bit, says an officer may use force to protect from apparent death or great bodily harm. So what was apparent here to your client when he used force?
To answer that question, that's an excellent question. And it also, though, we need to bring into this discussion the aspect of what Mr. Officer Noor was not allowed to testify about.
But before you go there, based on what's in the record now, what is the evidence about whether there was an apparent death or great bodily harm, or what was apparent to your client at that time?
Well, we have the testimony of his partner, Officer Harity. Officer Harity said he'd never been this scared in his entire life. We had the testimony of the two neighbors that were in the houses closest. They heard the knock, the slap on the car. We had not just Harity's testimony, but Harity's reaction. He went for his gun. He shouted either, "Oh shit," or "Oh Jesus," when he went for his gun. And then you have the idea that this is nighttime it is in a peaceful neighborhood, but the specter of ambush is been in the news.
And so let me, if I may, just to conserve time. So to drill down on that, what specifically about that evidence gives rise to a possibility of death or great bodily harm?
The fact that a person appears in the window unexpectedly and you can't see their arm and it's coming up. You don't know what's in the hand. It's very clear that if you wait, that you will die. The react versus act versus react. If this is an ambush, that both officers are dead. And Harity believed it was an ambush. That was his first thought. This is an ambush. And what officers know is that if you simply react, you're done. That's it. You're going to be just as dead as the officer 10 days prior in New York City that was ambushed. And, we saw the ambush just recently occurred in California. The officers were sitting in their car. This is a very legitimate concern. And, that is what's in the record that shows that this was not a fanciful thought. Noor was, of course, not allowed to testify as to the things, not the why, what were you thinking? He wasn't allowed to testify about that aspect of it, only that he thought it was an ambush.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There are no other questions from the panel members. Appellate's time for primary argument has expired. We'll hear now from counsel for the state. Would you please introduce yourself for the record before you begin your argument?
I will. May it please the court. My name is Jean Burdorf. I am an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota. Appellant Muhammad Noor and his former partner, Matthew Herity, were startled on July 15, 2017, when a silhouette appeared approaching their squad car. They were startled. They didn't see that silhouette's hands. They didn't see a weapon. They didn't hear a threat, and they didn't see any threatening behavior. Before Officer Herity could even appreciate or register what was happening, Muhammad Noor pulled out his gun, shot that gun across his partner's body in a very small space between Officer Herity and the squad window, and he struck that silhouette. That silhouette was Justine Ruschek. She was a 911 caller who had contacted the police that night looking for help. Muhammad Noor's actions were rash, they were heedless, and they were extremely dangerous, and they killed Justine Ruschek.
And the question is, did he have a depraved mind? And right, that's the question. That's one of the important
questions. It is one of the questions. It is one of the questions. And again, the elements, I will talk about why. Depraved mind isn't, as Mr. Plunkett described, it isn't this clouded by intoxication or clouded by passion. In fact, if you read State versus Middick, they say the exact opposite, which is that isn't what we're talking about when we say depraved. Depraved is sort of an antiquated common law notion. The elements of a depraved mind or third degree murder are that a death is caused by an eminently dangerous act by a person who performed that act with indifference or without regard to human life. Those elements are met here because, again, Muhammad Noor's decision to fire a gun across his partner's body at something that he didn't know it was Ms. Ruschek. He didn't even know if it was a man or a woman outside that window. And to fire a gun off in the presence of multiple people at something you don't even know who it is, what they're doing in that alley, that is eminently dangerous, and it is indifferent to human life.
Mr. Plunkett made reference to a line of cases concerning particular person. I'm sure you're familiar with it, culminating in Zumbergi. Does that case law still apply?
That case law, what the problem with Mr. Plunkett's interpretation of that case law is that he plucks language in isolation out of it, and then he also reads it out of context. And I want to talk about both of those points. First, in terms of taking that language in isolation, he has argued over and over that Muhammad Noor was focused on or his conduct was directed towards Justine Ruschek. Those words do appear in that body of case law, directed to, focused on, but it's part of a larger conversation. It is really without dispute, and this is where State versus Middick controls, that if you fire a gun in the general direction of a person, but you do that without intent to kill, that is a third degree murder. That is exactly what happened in Middick. We had a situation where a person fired a gun at two different people, killing one of them. And the district court who presided over the bench trial found, as a matter of fact, that the defendant did not act with intent to kill. There was really no question that the gunshots were fired in the general direction of the victims. The question was whether there was intent to kill. And it was the district court's finding that there was no intent to kill that actually pushed this case from a premeditated or intentional murder to an unintended killing that is done with indifference to human life. And as you look at the analysis in Middick, they go through the elements and they essentially say shooting off a gun where people are present is eminently dangerous. And you see that in Middick, you see it in the case I cited in supplemental authority. You also see it in Professor Lefebvre's treatise on substantive criminal law. shooting a gun off in a room with people or in the direction of a person without intent to kill is actually a classic example of depraved mind burner. So I want to
get clarity on my last question before we go forward, because in Zimbergi, sure. The court said that the third degree statute does not apply if, quote, defendant's actions were focused on a specific person, end quote. Is that still the law?
That's part of the law, but it had again, this is what I'm talking about when I say that we can't pluck the words focused on out of the larger conversation in that case law. What the case law actually says and what that language is trying to describe is the distinction between an intentional and an unintentional murder. And what they essentially say is you don't have a third degree murder if there is this is the operative language in the case law, special design, special regard, or special animus directed towards the particular person who is killed. That language is functionally synonymous with an intent to kill. That language is used in all of those cases, which are lesser included offense instruction cases, to describe the difference between those greater offenses, which are all intentional or premeditated murder, and the lesser offense of unintended depraved mind murder. So when you look at those cases, the context matters. So what the court is saying in each one of those cases is, should this defendant have received a lesser included instruction on third degree murder? And in each
Judge Larkin, I'm sorry to cut you
no,
off.
Absolutely.
I do have a question about the depraved mind element of the offense. When you listed the elements, I don't recall you saying depraved mind. It is in the statute. It is mentioned by the Supreme Court in the recent Hall decision. How do you define depraved mind?
Depraved mind is actually a term of art. So it is not a term where you look up a dictionary and you say it's, you know, moralist or immoral or things that you would find in a dictionary. That's what Middick says. Depraved mind, again, term of art. And what it really means is it's really twofold. You have to have your eminently dangerous act, and you have to have the act, and this is the mens rea of a third degree murder, which is without regard for human life. That's the mens rea of a depraved mind murder. It has to be something that is done regardless of human life. And if you look at the cases, and that's what Hall says, depraved mind without regard for human life. That's the mens rea, but depraved mind is defined by the indifference to human life.
And could you address what, if any, application our decision in State v. Coleman has to our analysis in this case?
I can. Actually, the issue in State versus Coleman is whether the crimjig for third degree murder describes the elements correctly and talks about the mental state as being without regard for human life. There's a second paragraph in the criminal or the pattern jig that describes the mental state as wanton or reckless, which is language that's lifted from State versus Lowe, which is the 1896 Minnesota Supreme Court case. The issue in Coleman was whether or not the statutory definition of the term reckless that is found in some of the gun offenses in Minnesota's Chapter 609 should have been given to the jury in that case. What this court said is that it should have been given a definition of recklessness, but that it wasn't plain error because there had been no law saying that. So the idea of Coleman is it reckless or is it indifference? Coleman has been petitioned to the Minnesota Supreme Court. That petition for review was granted. The Minnesota County Attorneys Association, which Hennepin County is part of, has actually filed an amicus brief in that particular case, and I will articulate for you the position we've taken there on this issue, which is that indifference or without regard to human life is the appropriate mental state for a third degree murder, and that just simple recklessness or the statutory definition of recklessness is inappropriate and actually confuses the distinction between a third degree murder, which is indifference to human life, and a culpable negligence manslaughter, which also includes a component of recklessness.
Counsel, what do you suggest we do with the Coleman case? Because I appreciate that it is a jury instruction case, but this case, the Court of Appeals clearly held that the depraved mind mental state required for third degree murder is equivalent to the reckless strictness standard that's set forth in these other cases, and we held that third degree murder requires proof that the defendant was aware that his conduct created a substantial and unjustifiable risk of death to another person and consciously disregarded that risk. I understand that the County Attorney's Association doesn't agree with the decision, but this is the law until it's overruled. If that standard is applied in this case, what result do we reach?
Well, I think under Minnesota Rule of Civil Appellate Procedure, I believe it's 136, a decision of the Court of Appeals that is petitioned to the Minnesota Supreme Court, the petition is granted, that essentially stays the judgment, and I would argue the precedential effect of Coleman. So I think that is one way that Coleman might not apply here. And respectfully, I would say, I think the argument that we've made about what the mental state is for third degree murder should be judged on its own merits, particularly given the grant of the petition for review in Coleman. All of that said, if you want to use a statutory recklessness standard, I don't think there's really any question that Muhammad Noor's conduct fit that definition of recklessness, which is a conscious disregard for the substantial likelihood of causing someone else bodily harm. He fired off a gun over his partner's body at a person who he didn't know, where there was a bicyclist in the area. That's incredibly, extremely, we would argue, eminently dangerous. And certainly as a trained police officer, he would have known, one, you don't fire your gun inside of a squad car. And two, and this is, there's evidence in the record to support all of these arguments, which is you don't fire at something that you don't know what it is and you don't know what's behind it. That's just basic firearm training for MPD.
Counsel, I'd like to take you back to the sort of the legal issue of what is the role of the particular person exclusion or requirement. It's called a couple of different things. And specifically, what do we make of footnote 9 in the State versus Hall decision?
I think footnote 9 supports the state's position, which is this, that the phrase, a third degree murder is committed without a special design towards a particular person really is functionally synonymous with the idea that it's an intent to kill distinction. And so when they say that language really is dealing with the element of depraved mind, what they're saying is that that element, that specific design piece and that particular person piece are what separate intentional and premeditated killings from an unintentional third degree murder. And again, the context of all that case, Zumberg, Wahlberg, Hansen, all of the cases Mr. Plunkett listed, all of them come up in the context of whether or not a lesser included offense instruction was warranted. The question
If I understand your argument is that because it's not an element of the offense, the lack of a particular or the focus on a particular person or lack thereof is not an element of murder three, it isn't relevant on a sufficiency challenge. Is that your argument?
Well, I agree with you. It's not an element, but again, I think there's a factual component that we really haven't talked about, which is what does the evidence show Muhammad Noor's mental state was? And we argue that it was rash, heedless, and eminently dangerous. It is important in this particular case that Muhammad Noor actually testified. And what he said is, I acted with particular intended to kill the person who was outside the squad window because I perceived a deadly threat from that person. That was his testimony. He was charged with second degree intentional murder based on what he had said to a defense investigator. The jury acquitted him of that offense. So this standard review that this court uses, that testimony about intent to kill or acting with a special design towards a particular person was presented to the jury as a matter of fact through his testimony, and it was rejected by the jury.
I'm sorry, maybe you weren't done. Complete.
To complete the answer is really just this, which is once the jury rejected the idea that he actually acted with intent to kill, this court just ignores it. And the argument that Mr. Plunkett has been making, really particularly about, even with the idea of the danger is Muhammad Noor saw the arm coming up. This was totally reasonable for him to have fired his weapon under these circumstances. All of that argument, if you really distill it down to its essence, is based on Muhammad Noor's testified version of events, which was rejected by the jury. On appeal, though, it's like those facts are invisible, and you look at what the remainder of the evidence suggests. And what the remainder of the evidence suggests is that Muhammad Noor fired his weapon over his partner's body at someone he didn't know what they were doing in the alley, with a bicyclist and other people, presumably nearby in a residential area. That is an eminently dangerous act, and that is an act that is performed with indifference or without regard to human life, and that is what made him guilty of third-degree murder.
If I could, if Judge Larkin, if I could ask one or two more questions. To follow up on Judge Bjorkman's question, I believe Mr. Plunkett argued that the particular person concept is not in itself a freestanding element of the offense, but it is incorporated into the third element, the concept of depraved mind, or he said words to that effect. Perhaps that's my restatement, but would you agree with that?
No, in this respect, which is the particular person element can't be divorced from what the language of those cases say, which is there has to be a specific or special design towards a particular person for the conduct to not meet the elements of third degree murder. That's just another way of saying that you can't have intent to kill. It's not a third degree murder if you are acting essentially with special animus towards the person you kill. That isn't the third degree murder. But I will say this about the particular person. That really just loops right back to the argument in Middick and what we were talking about earlier about behavior being directed towards or focused on a victim. That isn't the entirety of the concept. He's essentially arguing, because I shot my gun off at a particular person, there was a single person standing outside that window, I'm not guilty. That is not what the case law holds. To the extent that's what he's arguing about third degree murder and about what depraved mind means, I do strongly disagree with it. And I think Middick essentially defeats the argument.
So in Middick, the defendant, the Supreme Court said the defendant appeared to have been emotionally disturbed. Her mind was inflamed by emotions, disappointment, and hurt to such a degree that it ceases to care for human life. And she apparently had been in this state of mind for a matter of hours, if not days, while she traveled from Chicago to the Twin Cities to shoot her former lover. So isn't it sort of a stretch to say that the facts of this case are, or wouldn't we be stretching the Middick case and the Middick, perhaps it's an exception, or I think the Supreme Court said it's an atypical case, but wouldn't we be stretching it quite far to encompass the facts of this case where Noor's state of mind, the state of mind that you are, that you proved to the jury, was very momentary, sudden. It arose within a second or two, or perhaps in a split second. Is it possible for a depraved mind to form that quickly?
It is, indeed. And first of all, the statute and the case law don't say anything about the fact that, and it's not an element of third degree murder, that the indifference to human life has to exist for any particular period of time. That just isn't part of the statute. It isn't part of the case law. Just because there are cases where someone had an inflamed, jealous state of mind or was intoxicated doesn't mean that that's a necessary element of the third degree murder offense. If you look at, again, Lefebvre, the treatise on substantive criminal law, if you look at his section on the creation of risk that is cited in my brief, he gives a laundry list of sort of classic or typical examples of third degree murder. And one of them is shooting off a gun, not with the intent to kill, but where other people are present. That is an act. That's what Muhammad Noor did. And the fact that he was startled or panicked or spooked, in the words of Officer Heresy, all of those things are consistent with the eminently dangerous act and indifference to human life. He was trained to use his gun. He was trained to assess the danger in a particular circumstance. He was startled and he reacted. And even though it was in a second, he had to know and be aware that shooting off a gun over his partner's lap, which is not consistent with his training or prevailing police practices and shooting at a silhouette where a bicyclist was in the neighborhood, he had to be aware of the fact that that was gravely dangerous to human life. And the fact that he did it anyway shows that he was indifferent to the lives of the people he endangered.
Counsel, I wonder if I could direct your attention to Mittick. I wonder if it's not an issue of someone developing a depraved mind instantaneously, as opposed to a person having a depraved mind, which is evidenced by an act. And I think there's a distinction there. And Mittick does talk about an act could be proof of an underlying depraved mind, even though we might not see evidence in other context. And specifically mentions an act showing an inclination to mischief and that the doer had no regard for social duty. So I mean, that is that more what you're arguing in terms of the act evidencing a depraved mind as opposed to intent? When was intent or premeditation? When was it formed? We're not really talking about that. We're just talking about the underlying condition.
That's exactly right. And again, the Lefebvre section on substantive criminal law that I've cited, that is precisely what that section discusses, which is the fact that there are some acts that are so eminently dangerous, like shooting over your partner's body at someone you don't know, where there's other people nearby, that actually is what reflects indifference to human life, because there is no reasonable way to believe that someone didn't appreciate the risk of their actions. That's really what it is. The nature of the act actually can also demonstrate the indifference to human life.
All right. I see your time is up. Do the panel members have any additional questions for the state?
Thank you. We just ask that you affirm Mr. Neuer's convictions.
All right, thank you, counsel. We'll now hear rebuttal argument from counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. At this time, I don't have anything to offer on rebuttal to those comments. We rest on our briefs.
Do the panel members have any additional questions for appellant's counsel? Judge Johnson.
I'm checking my notes, Judge Larkin, just to, I don't believe I do, no.
Well, then on behalf of the court, I'd like to thank the attorneys for their briefing and their arguments this morning. The matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days as is required by statute. Thank you. That concludes the court's oral argument calendar this morning. The court will now proceed with its non-oral calendar.